In some circles, network is a dirty word, something we don't like to talk about, lest we admit out loud that maybe, just maybe, we did not get where we are in the world today by grit and hard work alone. I'm guessing a lot of us got where we are through a combination of hard work and a few helpful connections along the way.
A lot of times it's not about what you know, it's about who you know.
Do you think that's fair?
Not all the time, but occasionally, yes.
When it works out in your favor. Networks are all around us, if we're lucky. But not everyone is that lucky.
As far as finding a legal job, it was hard. But as far as finding anything else that's bad in the world, the network can find a lot of bad things.
I'm Jennifer Guerra. Today on our show, networks. Why we need them, how we form them, and what to do if you have no network to begin with. That's ahead on Connections, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. But first, the news.
When I say the word network, how would you guys describe network? Like, what does the word network mean to you?
Communications.
I would say, like, different branches of people that you can, like,
reach out to. Like, I sort of picture it visually, like, almost like a family tree or something.
You hear the word, I think of getting connected.
Networking
connections.
When you connect with professionals in your desired field or your current occupation, and then they introduce you to, like, their knowledge, and then their knowledge,
circulates. When I think of networking, I picture, like, a spider's web where everything is connected together. If you have connections, then you can get a lot of help.
I like that. Let's stick with that spider web image for a minute. It's a good one. So if you think of a network as a spider's web, maybe you would be in the middle.
Okay, we're just going to turn this on here. Okay.
And maybe your parents would be right above you in the web.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Mom.
Hello, Jenny.
Hi, Dad.
That's my mom and dad.
Hi, Millie.
And my little girl in the background. If we are going to talk about networks, specifically if I am going to talk about my network, these two, my parents, are right at the heart of it, as close to the center of the web as you can get. In some circles, network is a dirty word, something we don't like to talk about, lest we admit out loud that maybe, just maybe, we did not get where we are in the world today by grit and determination and hard work alone. I'm guessing many of us got where we are through a combination of hard work and a few helpful connections along the way. Maybe it was that relative who gave you your first summer job, or your friend's mom who let you clerk at her law office so you could have something impressive to put on your resume. Or, you know, maybe that math teacher who wrote a letter of recommendation on your behalf to the school of your dreams, which also happened to be his alma mater. Networks are all around us, if we're lucky. Here, I'm going to show you how my network helped me get here, literally right here behind this microphone, talking to you. It starts with my parents.
Okay, so for the record, we should introduce who you are. So you are?
Ava Guerra.
Also known as?
Mom.
And you are?
Frank Guerra.
Also known as?
Dad.
Dad, okay, thank you.
Well, you were
my parents were incredibly supportive in all the ways you hope parents will be.
Jazz,
they got me to school every day. They signed me up for a bunch of extracurricular activities, took me on lots of adventures. Sure, I probably wanted another Cabbage Patch Kid, but hey, what 8-year-old in 1986 didn't? But in terms of basic needs and all that, I was more than covered. They had my back financially, emotionally, and academically. And for some reason, they insisted that we, me and my brothers, write a lot. Which, now that I think of it, is kind of key if you want to be a reporter.
What did you guys do when we got in trouble? Do you remember if, like, me and my brothers got in a fight? Yeah, do you remember?
Well, I didn't let you continue arguing. I told you each to go and write a paragraph or two, whatever it took, as to your perception of what happened, and then hand it to the other person so that they could read it and see how you felt.
So you had me writing essays, like when I was six. Do you remember these essays, Dad?
Yes, I do.
We had to read them out loud.
So my network helped me develop, among many other things, empathy and early writing skills. And then, of course, there were the people who actually introduced me to public radio, like my friend Georgia.
My name is Georgia Flight. I am 37 years old, and I live in Montauk, New York.
Georgia and I met in college. She used to play NPR all the time.
All things considered, to get my news wrap up, And
okay, let's pan her to the left side of the spider's web. Just above her in the web, my friends Ellen.
Hello.
And Margaret.
Hello.
Two longtime friends who helped me prep for the GRE.
Glad I was there to help you.
And gave me advice about grad school. Over on the right side of the web, you've got my friend Gavin, who got me a good paying temp job in New York so I could pay rent while I was in grad school.
You know, it sort of was a chain reaction. So one Michigan person got another Michigan person.
And then when it comes to the radio side of things, I had a lot of people give me a hand, like Angie Hamilton Lowe.
Hey, Jen.
Hi, Angie. And Julianne Welby.
Hi, Jen.
They taught me everything about radio, from the nuts and bolts of how to record an interview.
Digital audio editing probably was what we started with.
To how to come up with a good story.
We mainly talk a lot about ideas and try to draw.
I used Julianne as a reference to land this job 10 years ago. Back then, it was rather low paying, so there were my parents back at the center of the web helping me make ends meet.
Yes, we tried. We tried to help you out. Really strong, yes. You know,
that right there, what you're hearing, that is the sound of a strong, robust network.
A large school with a huge network.
Now imagine you don't have teachers in your network who can coach you, or close friends who have time and resources to help you when you need it. And the heart of your web, your parents, aren't around or are not capable of supporting you. That's what a network can sound like for somebody in poverty. Somebody like Keisha Johnson.
I slept outside once in the alley. Yep. My mom was in the house drunk, and we're bamming on the door, my brothers and sisters and I. We bamming. We couldn't get in, so I slept outside on a mattress in the alley.
Were you scared?
I mean, I had to do what I had to do. I slept on the porch a couple of times before because my mom would be in the house drunk and high, and we couldn't get in.
Johnson grew up poor. And she's still poor now. But she has four reasons she wants to climb out of poverty. Reason number one, Keisha's six-year-old son, Caleb. Reason number two,
how old are you, Journey?
Five.
And what grade are you in?
Kindergarten.
Reason number three, the Halloween-loving three-year-old, Alan.
I'm gonna be Spider-Man.
And reason number four.
Oh, there you go.
Keisha's youngest boy, one-year-old Ian.
Love my babies. I want my children to be loving, caring, not violent. You know what I mean? I don't want them to go through what I went through.
I first met Keisha Johnson 3 years ago when she was 24 years old. We've talked every few months since then. One of the things I've consistently noticed about her is that no matter what is going on in her life, she always comes across as positive and upbeat, quick to smile. That is no small feat, considering the world Keisha Johnson grew up in. There were no nursery rhymes, lullabies, or bedtime stories for Keisha and her three siblings when they were growing up in Detroit. There were too many roaches in the house, and never enough food. Keisha's mom did not go to college or have a steady job, and she never sobered up enough to raise her children. Keisha's dad is serving life in prison for murdering his stepbrother. Eventually, Keisha and her siblings moved in with their grandmother, Ella. Keisha says she thrived there. She got into college. But then things started to slip. The only network she had was Grandma Ella, and Ella was far away from campus. She had nobody to lean on for help or guidance. She sold drugs, she got pregnant, and dropped out.
Come see our room!
Can I come see your room?
Yes.
Okay. Do you mind?
Today, the world Keisha Johnson is trying to create for her four children is vastly different from the world she grew up in. Keisha Johnson wants to provide a future for her kids, but how do you do that when you're pretty much on your own? I'm Jennifer Guerra. Today on our State of Opportunity special, networks. Why we need them, how we form them, and what to do if you have no network to begin with. That was the reality Keisha Johnson faced 3 years ago. Today, she's 27 years old and a little better off. More on that in a minute. But first, I ask her to think back to what her life was like 3 years ago when we first met.
If you were looking for a job, did you have people in your network who had jobs that could help you out?
No.
So you didn't have somebody who was working a job that you could be like, oh, hey, can you get me an interview or anything like that?
No.
What about if you, I know your car wasn't working so great, did you have anybody in your network who could help you out with car payments or help you fix the car or help you get a new lease?
Car payments, definite no. Fixing the car, that's when I learned to fix all my cars myself, worked to my grandfather and my uncle. I just watched them work on the cars, and then I did it myself because I knew I couldn't afford it.
What else do we use networks for? So for jobs, for financial security. Yeah. So who did you have to lean on?
My grandma. That was it. I didn't have anybody else. I can always go to my grandma and talk. But other than that, my networking was very, very, very minimal.
So Keisha did what thousands of others in her situation do every day. She turned to nonprofits as well as the state and federal governments for help. And she got a lot of it. Still does. Food stamps, medical insurance, daycare, housing assistance, and job training. And it's helped. The state and nonprofits stepped in when no one else could or would. They became her de facto network. But it still isn't enough. You can't call up the state when you're short on diapers or need help with your broken down car. If you have to go to work and your kids are sick at home, a nonprofit isn't going to step in to babysit or buy you a new laptop for school. That is where these folks come in.
This is exciting.
Have you ever been here?
Never. This is my first time.
I'm with Keisha Johnson as we walk up to the front door of Judy Friedman's house, a beautiful colonial in one of Ann Arbor's toniest neighborhoods.
Hi!
Can I take off my shoes?
No, just wipe them on.
Judy's there, along with Gary and Carol Johnson, no relation to Keisha Johnson. Up until 3 years ago, they were all strangers. Nobody knew each other. That is until they heard Keisha share her story on Michigan radio. After she heard the radio story, Judy Friedman turned to her husband and said,
"You know, something really is motivating me to try to meet this woman. I feel so touched by her, and I feel for her situation, and I want to see if there's a way we can help." And he said, "Go for it."
In a later radio story I did about Keisha, I followed her as she walked her kids in the freezing cold to and from daycare because her car had broken down. When Carol and Gary Johnson heard that story, well, I'll let Gary take it from here.
It appeared to me that she had exhausted whatever network she had. It was probably minimal in the first place, but she had exhausted it. So we thought, well, so many good things have happened to us, not all. And we thought, well, it's time to be part of a network, not to be looking for one.
And so Gary and his wife bought Keisha a used car and drove it from where they live in Milford over to Keisha's apartment in Detroit. After they dropped it off, they took Keisha and her kids shopping as well. That car that the Johnsons bought for Keisha was key. It got Keisha to and from her job training program at Focus Hope, a nonprofit in Detroit. Without a car, she might have had to drop out. That program led to a job for Keisha after she graduated, so having the Johnsons provide her with a car to and from class was essential. Judy Friedman has done all kinds of things for Keisha as well. She's bought Christmas gifts for Keisha's kids and a real Christmas tree for the apartment. She also helps out with money on occasion. Even with a job, money is tight for Keisha, so Judy's generosity helps Keisha buy much-needed items like shoes for the kids and diapers for the baby. Judy also hooked up Keisha with a laptop and printer so Keisha could do her homework. She's also become a kind of mentor for Keisha, helping her stay on track and focused as Keisha tries to climb her way out of poverty.
That's what I love about Mr. Johnson and Judy and Ms. Johnson. Like, they were there for me when I didn't have no one else. I have my family, don't get me wrong, but my family is barely making it. When you have a network, it's not saying easy, but you're on a narrow road, but it opens it up a little bit wider for you to hopefully succeed. So a network is very important, and I'm so happy I have that now.
There's no saying where Keisha Johnson and her four kids would be right now if Judy Friedman and the Johnsons hadn't heard Keisha on the radio and forced their paths to cross. As Keisha herself points out, when everybody you know is barely making it themselves, it's extremely challenging to move up the ladder. Keisha did the best she could with her limited network, her boyfriend, the state, and a few nonprofits, but it still wasn't enough. It took people from way outside her network to take a chance on her, step in, and offer support. people who found out about her because a reporter told her story on the radio, something most people in her situation will never have the chance to experience. Coming up, when you don't have a network, but the network finds you.
I kind of view this as our kids' country club. This is where they're making the connections for themselves. This is where they're talking to so-and-so who could help get them a job over the summer. They're talking to someone who can help put in a good word for them at a university or a scholarship fund. So it really gives our kids access to some people that they would never have access to.
How one school connects low-income high school students with white-collar professionals. That's in 10 minutes. You are listening to Connections, The Power of Networks, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. You are listening to Connections, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio about the power of networks. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Before the break, we heard from a young mother in poverty who is struggling to build a network out of nothing. So I thought I'd switch things up for a few minutes here and talk to somebody who is a pro at networking. He has one of the best networks around, at least in my circle of friends. His name is Chris Druin. I caught up with him at the Office Coffee Shop in Royal Oak. And after we hug and say what's up, he immediately starts pitching me on the place. I mean, he can't help it. He is a born networker.
This whole front section here is Michigan-made products, and it's one of those like monthly services.
I met Chris in high school. He's a few years older than me. When I posted a status update on my Facebook page asking for folks to name the best networker they knew, Druin named himself.
I don't know if I said I'm the best networker. I'm cocky, but I'm not that cocky. I'm frequently known from my friends as the guy that's got a guy. If you blew out a tire in a pothole, call Drew and he's got a guy. You need a handyman, a mortgage banker, a plumber. I mean,
you get the picture. He is connected to so many people through his work, through his church, through his college fraternity. He even refs lacrosse teams in the area. Now, Druin does come from an upper middle class background. His parents are both professionals. So to a large extent, his network was already made for him. But it wasn't really until college that he realized just how important it was to be a good networker.
In college, I was a bartender. And I think that was kind of, I always kind of looked at being behind the bar as being the host of a party to make sure everyone at the bar was having a good time. Because the better time they had, the better my tips were.
Since then, he's graduated and he's done everything from finance to social media management. But he says in terms of learning how to network, you can't beat being a bartender. So I ask him, what networking advice would you give to somebody who's 18 or 19 years old and comes from a very low-income family?
I would get to any restaurant I could, anywhere in Oakland County. If I was in Detroit, I would make sure I'd go to Midtown or Corktown or down in Greektown and just beg, borrow, and plead for a job that started doing whatever. I'll bus tables, I'll host, I'll bar back, I'll wash dishes. And just tell them with the attitude of, but I want to work my way up to bartender. Like, if you give me a job, I will show up on time every single day. I will work my butt off. I will pick up any shift you want. But I eventually want to get behind the bar because it's really good money. It's a really good way to network and find opportunities.
I think it's a great idea.
I'd like you to meet restaurant owner Dennis Archer Jr.
I mean, I look at my bartenders and the type of clientele that we have that comes here. From all walks of life, some very notable, some extraordinarily successful. And if you're the bartender or the server, you talk to everybody. I mean, that's your job. And so I can't think of any better way for someone that doesn't have that exposure to get that exposure.
Dennis Archer Jr. owns Central Kitchen and Bar in Midtown Detroit. He's also the son of former Detroit Mayor Dennis Archer. Dennis Archer Jr. has an ease about him. The kind of guy who looks just as comfortable in a boardroom as he does at a bar. And while he didn't set out to build a formal network for inner-city youth in Detroit, he has created an informal network for at least one teen who works at his restaurant.
Literally, every time I'm sitting here eating with somebody, I drag them over here and introduce them to people all the time. And inevitably, those people say, hey, well, if I can do anything to help you, let me know, or that sort of thing.
Through this restaurant, I've met a lot of important people. It's like, it's great. Every day you see new faces. So it's like your opportunities never end.
This is Devin Johnson. He's a 16-year-old high school senior who has quickly discovered there are more benefits to this busboy thing than just earning some extra cash.
Since I've been here, I have quite a few business cards in my wallet.
For real?
Yeah.
Like, do you have your wallet on you?
Yeah.
Let's look at that.
This one is from his friend Willie. This one is from Franklin and Marshall.
That's a college.
This one is from Ambassador Magazine.
Devin says whenever Dennis Archer Jr. introduces him, he calls Devin a superstar and a real hard worker. That is when they slip him their business cards.
Do you think that other 16-year-olds in the city have a wallet that's stacked with business cards from, like, high-ranking people?
No. To be honest, I don't think so.
How does it make you feel to be able to have something like this?
I mean, it makes me feel like I'm important, like I actually matter.
It's just about exposure.
Here is Dennis Archer Jr. again.
I mean, a lot of these kids, if they were to go with a professional just for a single day, I think it would be very eye-opening. But let alone have an ongoing relationship with someone, I think it's very important for those of us who have can afford the time, because it's not really an expense, to spend time with a kid. I mean, we all have, I'm involved in a lot. I have two great kids myself. But I can even find in my busy schedule some time to help guide or provide, you know, some insights and leadership to another young kid.
You are listening to Connections, the Power of Networks, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Dennis Archer Jr. hit on something that I want to explore a bit more. This idea of stepping in to be a mentor to somebody you have no connection to. You're not related, it's not even a friend of a friend, you don't run in the same social circles. So why do it? I put that question to a guy named Joaquin Nuno Whalen.
A big passion of mine is the gap that's happening in Detroit. There's a big gap of talent that we're not getting into the workforce.
Nuno Whalen is a chief engineer at General Motors. He does a lot of recruiting for GM, and he is tired of bringing in talent from other states. He wants to find talent here, in Michigan. So he's figured out a way to give underrepresented high school students real, hands-on engineering experience and help build the pipeline of talent in the area. He's teamed up with a Catholic high school in southwest Detroit. It's called Cristo Rey. Nuno Whalen is one of hundreds of white-collar workers in southeast Michigan who work with and mentor students there. Here's how it works. One day a week, beginning with freshman year, Cristo Rey students go to work for a white-collar company, like a law firm or an insurance agency, or, since this is Detroit, one of the car companies. Nuno Whalen, from GM, sees it as a win-win for both the auto industry and for the students.
The fact that the kids get to go to work one day a week is hugely mind-opening, eye-opening. The kids get to see things they would never have gotten to see. And it starts to instill some inspiration, but also it connects the dots as, oh, it is that easy. I just have to do this.
After 4 years in high school with an engineering internship, plus 4 years of college, Nuno Whalen says GM is going to be dying to hire these kids. And their resumes will float to the top of the pile because now they know people on the inside. Mike Corey is president of Cristo Rey High School in Detroit. He says making sure the kids are challenged in school is, of course, a top priority. But he says the jobs program is really what helps level the playing field between rich kids from the suburbs and poor kids from the city.
I kind of view this as our kids' country club. This is where they're making the connections for themselves. This is where they're talking to so-and-so who could help get them a job over the summer. They're talking to someone who can help put in a good word for them at a university or a scholarship fund. So it really gives our kids access to some people that they would never have access to.
Corey tells me one donor gave a Cristo Rey student a $40,000 college scholarship. Another student got his tuition nearly covered by the company he interned for. And I'm told a bunch of students have already been promised full-time jobs when they finish college. So who gets into Cristo Rey? Well, the one in southwest Detroit is part of a national chain of high schools. There are 30 total across the country. Many of the schools have wait lists, but the Detroit one is still pretty new, so They're just trying to fill seats at this point. All the schools are specifically for low-income youth who otherwise would not be able to afford private school. At the Cristo Rey High School in Southwest Detroit, the vast majority of students are Hispanic or African American, and the average family income is under $30,000. Parents kick in about $600 to $700 a year for tuition. The job partners cover the rest. So while the students do work, they don't get a paycheck. The money they earn at their internship goes to pay their private school tuition at Cristo Rey.
In many cases, our students have the best job of anyone in their family. And so this is important for our kids to see what opportunities are there. And then, because the companies are so welcoming to our students and encouraging, it's real easy for our kids to see the path to getting that as a career for them. But that path includes college.
Hi, my name is Loretta Burrell. I am a junior at Detroit Cristo Rey High School, and I work at GM.
I met up with Loretta during her second week as a student intern at General Motors. She's got the whole professional thing down. Strong handshake, direct, looks you in the eye. Right when we start to talk, the fire alarm goes off. So Loretta and I and the 8,000 other folks inside the GM Tech Center in Warren hit the stairs and head outside to the sprawling GM campus. While everybody around us is all abuzz about the fire drill, Loretta is the essence of calm. I don't find out until much later that fire is something she's all too familiar with. At 16 years old, she has experienced more trauma and heartbreak in her young life than anybody should. A house fire killed both her brothers earlier this year. Cortez Jr. was a senior at Cristo Rey. Cortez was in seventh grade. She understandably does not like to talk about it. But perhaps that, more than anything, has made her more determined to succeed in life.
I just want to work hard and be successful and give back to the people that have been through what I've been through, whether it was from a family member passing away or just losing everything. So that's what I would like to do.
She plans to make a living as a mechanical engineer and a math professor.
Have you ever met an engineer before?
No, I haven't.
When I say the word network, what do you think of?
The people that I know.
Do you think you have a strong network?
As of right now, no. But I feel like if I continue to work at GM and am exposed to different people and their different occupations, then I feel like I will have a strong network, yes.
How important is that?
It's very important because a lot of times it's not about what you know, it's about who you know and who can help you out and get you to where you need to be.
Do you think that's fair?
Not all the time, no. But occasionally, yes.
When it works out in your favor.
Right.
So soon you'll be somebody who knows somebody at GM.
Right. Yes. In the future I will be, yes.
But like 2 weeks ago, did you know anybody at GM?
Not at all. No, I didn't. But 2 weeks later, I know a handful of people, and that makes me feel better.
Now, it's not like she's building or designing cars at GM. For the first month while I was there, it was mostly just data entry stuff, some PowerPoint presentations, getting acquainted with the whole corporate culture. But Loretta is meeting people who do have clout at GM. And the internship lasts all year long, so she's guaranteed to interact with all types of engineers during that time. Plus, I'm told, Loretta will get to do mock interviews, work on her elevator pitch for what she wants to do when she grows up, and get help with her resume. Three networking skills that will definitely come in handy when she graduates college. Twenty miles away in Auburn Hills, Osvaldo Lopez is getting his first taste of life as an engineer, not at General Motors, but at Fiat Chrysler.
Hey, Osvaldo, it's your first day. Good to see you, too. This is Jennifer.
Osvaldo is a sophomore at Cristo Rey. He is shy and soft-spoken. This is his second year interning at Chrysler.
Last year, I was nervous I would get lost because it's big, but I'm not that nervous this year.
Last year, he worked in the product design department at Chrysler. This year, he is going to work in powertrain engineering with his new mentor, Aaron Waskevich.
I work in the lab, the hardware in the loop lab. Hardware in the loop is
these big machines that electrically simulate the car.
In other words, everything that interfaces with the engine, Waskevich and her team have a hand in. And lucky Osvaldo, he gets to work with her. We go down to the basement level to the powertrain lab. Waskevich's desk is covered in cables and wires and intricate-looking computer chips. And within minutes, she has Osvaldo disassemble a silver piece of hardware called a module.
Okay, so gently pull this connector out and this connector off.
And with that, his internship has officially begun.
Yep, that's right.
Just now, let's leave Osvaldo there for a few minutes so we can get to know his mentor a bit better. I dropped by Aaron Waskevich's house one sunny Sunday afternoon.
Hi, Jennifer. Good. How are you?
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yes. Let me get you a drink. Would you like iced tea or lemonade or pop, coffee, hot tea?
Waskevich has this hosting thing down. She baked us all kinds of goodies. Oatmeal raisin cookies, Rice Krispie treats, brownies. There is also apple slices and caramel. I tell you all this not to make you hungry, but to point out just the kind of person she is. She goes out of her way to make people feel at home. Like there's nothing better she'd rather be doing with her time than sitting inside on a gorgeous day talking to you. You can just tell this mentoring thing is in her bones.
I love it. It's one of my favorite parts of my job. Because I feel like you can make a difference. Send somebody in a good direction, you know, and hopefully they learn things and they might decide what they want to be.
Do you see any like parallels between your upbringing and the kids who are going to Cristo Rey?
Yeah, you know, I don't know, you know, everybody's background, you know, and I do know that we always had what we needed, but when I went away to college, you know, I met people that their kids, every time they go on like summer break, their parents would get them a job. They had like summer jobs in like professional offices and things because their parents knew somebody or their parents, you know, set it up for them. And it was never like that for me. You know, I've done it all on my own.
Waskevich's mom grew up poor in the shadow of the coal mines in West Virginia. Eventually, her mom moved to Detroit, found a job, and worked from the time she was a teen to the time she retired. By the time Waskevich was born, her mom and dad had worked their way up to the middle class.
You know, not big house middle class, but like smaller house middle class.
Her neighborhood was mostly working class folks, nurses and medical technicians, that type of thing. She wanted to be an engineer, but she didn't know any in her network or her neighborhood. So at college in the Upper Peninsula, she went the co-op route. She'd go to school for a couple semesters, then work at an engineering firm for a couple semesters, back and forth until she graduated. And she firmly believes her co-op job got her where she is today, as one of the engineers in Fiat Chrysler's powertrain division.
Any opportunities I've had since then have all come from the experience or the people I've met back then. And that's what I love about the Cristo Rey program. I just love so much that these kids are getting this opportunity, you know, to meet people and get real world experience and contacts.
Talk about contacts. One ninth grader I talked to at Cristo Rey, who wants to be an engineer, told me he had already added 30 new engineering professional contacts to his LinkedIn profile. Back in the powertrain lab at Fiat Chrysler, Aaron Waskevich tells me and Osvaldo, her current intern, about how the last Cristo Rey student she mentored got to meet somebody very high up in the company.
She got to speak with many key people in human resources, and she mentioned to these people how she would love to meet Sergio.
Sergio Marchione?
Yes, ma'am.
Have you met Sergio?
No. I've seen him in the hall. I've seen him. I have not spoke to him.
Turns out the president of Fiat Chrysler, Sergio Marchione, was too busy to meet with the student. But she did get to meet his second in command. She actually had a one-on-one meeting with him, got to ask him questions. Apparently it went really well. So I ask Osvaldo, if you could meet one of the bigwigs at Fiat Chrysler, what would you ask? Nothing sprung to mind immediately for him. It's understandable. This is, after all, only his second week at the company. But then he pipes up and says, yeah, he has a question for Sergio Marchione.
All right, how is it like to be owner of a big company?
Do you think you'd ever want to own a big company?
I mean, yeah, I think everybody does.
Well, if he plays his cards right, he just might. Coming up, when you're locked up in prison, away from everyone and everything you know and love, how do you build a new life for yourself when you get out?
I had no community to come home to. My parents were elderly. My brothers and sisters were grown and gone. I was literally starting over with what I came home with.
Life and networks after prison. That story in 10 minutes. I'm Jennifer Guerra. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. Hi, I'm Jennifer Guerra, and you are listening to Connections, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. If you're just joining us this hour, we are talking about networks, specifically folks who lack networks and what that means for their futures. If you don't have a network, it can be very difficult to advance socially or in your career. One nonprofit leader I spoke to called it a crisis of relationships. That's exactly the kind of crisis DeAndre Austin faced 5 years ago.
As far as finding a legal job and a guaranteed paycheck job, it was hard. But as far as finding anything else that's bad in the world, the network can find a lot of bad things, you know.
That is the beauty and the beast, if you will, of networks. If your network is diverse with upwardly mobile people, people who have resources and can help you out, you're probably going to do okay. But if your network is largely homogenous, filled with people struggling just like you, you're in trouble. As DeAndre tells it, his mom had a hard time providing for herself, DeAndre, and his two brothers. So when DeAndre was 17, he struck out on his own and relied on his network to help him find a place to live. But the only people in his network were homeless teens and drug dealers. So those are the people who stepped in to help.
And basically, I lived in a foreclosure crib at one point in time. So no lights, no electricity. You got to heat up hot water to clean yourself, and you know, so.
Did you have to do anything not quite legal to make money?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. I definitely didn't do the right, I wasn't on the right path making the money. But I was making the money, but I wasn't doing the right things to get it, no.
DeAndre says he sold drugs and had people steal things for him. But he also says he tried to get a job. He says he called tons of places, fast food joints, big box stores, you name it, he applied. But nobody would hire him. Until one day, he got a call.
Come on down to the back of the warehouse.
2 years ago, DeAndre hooked up with a nonprofit in Ypsilanti for homeless youth. Through that group, he heard about Food Gatherers. He did a job training program at Food Gatherers, and when a job opened up, he applied and got it.
Well, I'm the warehouse facility assistant. We got the pantry freezer over there. We got two big, great produce pallets that I put out every single morning.
Here he is, working at a food bank that helps feed people who are homeless. He used to be one of those people. The irony is not lost on him. But he knows if he finds himself in trouble now, without a place to sleep or something to eat, he has got people in his network that can help him out.
I think I got a little bit more people than I had. Way more people than I had, actually, but... I had none, but I think I got like at least two or three people I can call.
Where do you think you would be if, you know, you hadn't done the work zone and hadn't gotten into Food Gatherers? And
who knows? Basically, I'm pretty sure I'd be in the wrong field. This job haven't hired me. I'm pretty sure I'd be like dead or in jail or prison, you know.
I'm Jennifer Guerra. This is Connections, the Power of Networks, a State of Opportunity special on Michigan Radio. So what happens to people who do wind up in prison? From what I've been told, it's lonely and isolating. You're totally separated from the life and the world you knew before you went in. How do you create connections in a place like that? Well, for some prisoners, connection starts with people on the outside, specifically college students from the University of Michigan.
We're going to dance and do ridiculous things, and like we're all going to do it together, and that's why it's not going to be embarrassing. So what's going
to
happen?
Welcome to the first night of a theater workshop at Cooper Street Prison in Jackson. University of Michigan senior Paris LaRocque leads about a dozen men, most in their 20s and 30s, in the first of four improv games they'll play this hour.
All right, Sheldon. Hey, Sheldon!
What?
Show us how you get down.
No way.
Show us how you get down.
Okay. D. O. W.
Now, aside from their blue and orange prison uniforms, you quickly forget that we're in a prison. There's dancing and laughter and what looks like real joy on the guys' faces. The class is part of the U of M's Prison Creative Arts Project, or PCAP. It's been around for 25 years. Here's how it works. Professors and students from U of M travel to prisons all over Southeast Michigan, leading inmates in theater workshops, writing and painting workshops. The classes last a whole semester, and at the end, the inmates put on a show of some kind for their fellow prisoners.
We'd have improv, and we would play freeze, and we learned some of the real basic theater skills that I still really enjoy to this day.
This woman, Mary, was one of the first prisoners ever to act in a PCAP play. She was released from prison over a decade ago, but she asked that we not use her last name because she doesn't want to suffer from employment discrimination in the future. Mary entered prison when she was 21, and like a lot of 21-year-olds, perhaps even more so, she had a lot of stuff going on in her head that she needed to work through, things like grief, sickness, life in general. But she had no real friends on the inside to talk to. And so the U of M students and teachers who came in weekly to teach the theater workshop, they became her friends, her network.
There was plenty of times when PCAP really kept me going because it's hard to be snowed in a facility in the dead of winter and not have any connection to the outside world. So to have somebody with that level of commitment that's really working with you and you can really feel changes in yourself, that's extremely important to people's survival and certainly to mine.
Mary was in prison for over two decades, and by the time she was released, her parents had moved to a new city. So she was paroled near them, far from where she had grown up and everything she had once known.
I had no community to come home to. I had my beautiful family, who I loved dearly, but my parents were elderly. My brothers and sisters were grown and gone. I was literally starting over with what I came home with.
All she had was a red three-piece knit suit she had saved up to buy and a pair of black heels. She says the only thing the prison gave her when she walked out the door was $5 and three condoms.
That's what they thought I needed for reentry.
Her only saving grace, she says, was the network she had formed with PCAP.
There's so much you don't know about being free when you haven't been free for a very long time. And just the reorientation and the ability to be in a community of friends, of people that really like you and respect you and honor your work, that's tremendous.
Ever since her release from prison, Mary has done just about everything she can with PCAP. She's been a guest speaker. She's mentored ex-felons returning home. She's even helped curate some of the art shows. And now she works for PCAP. She co-teaches one of U of M's prison workshops. She used PCAP as a launching pad for her new life on the outside, a life she had waited some 20 years to begin. Now, Mary left prison in the early 2000s. Back then, Michigan did not have any kind of formalized program to help ex-felons reenter society. Mary and thousands of other ex-felons were completely on their own when it came to rebuilding their networks and community. Today, things are better. In 2005, the state launched its Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative. The goal? To help the thousands of inmates paroled every year learn some kind of marketable skill, find a job, and stay out of prison. That is how Calvin Evans wound up here, as the guy in charge of hiring and firing people at a frame-making company in Ann Arbor called Urban Ashes. He got the job through a parolee re-entry program in Brighton that trains and hires the chronically underemployed. At the time, he was doing a job where he had to sort engine brackets, One day, a supervisor came over and said,
"We need help over in the urban ashes department. Do you know anything about wood?" And I was like, "Know how to use a tape measure." he actually asked me how many 16ths is in an eighth. And so because of my experience and, you know, my criminal activity, I knew.
Let's pause here and talk a little bit about Calvin Evans' criminal activity, the reason he wound up in prison for 24 years. The way Evans tells it, his family lived in poverty, and his mom was in an abusive relationship. So she sent Calvin and his brothers to live with their grandmother in Detroit.
My grandmother, she used to work for General Motors, and I used to see her coming home, and she had this soot all over it, and she used to cough it up.
His grandmother used to work on the line at General Motors.
I'm seeing all this, like, hard-working people, but we were still poor. But I didn't know how to solve this problem.
The only people he saw making good money around him were the drug dealers in his neighborhood. This was back in the 1980s when crack cocaine was running rampant through the city.
So I began to hang around them in their cars, you know, and they used to take me shopping. So they're kind of like courting me, if you will. They're petitioning me to be a part of this drug world, and I'm fascinated with this whole thing. And so
he liked the lifestyle they could offer. He was sick of being poor. He figured dealing drugs was an easy way to make money. Plus, he told himself and his mom that he was doing it for the family. He'd sell drugs so his little brothers wouldn't have to. So there he is one night in Mount Clemens with a bunch of other guys doing a drug deal when things go wrong, horribly wrong. Shots start flying, and one guy was shot and killed. Evans still swears he did not do it, but he was convicted of murder and served 24 years. When it was time for his parole in 2013, he had a plan. He was going to be the best ex-con he could be. He was going to fly right, go to school, get a job. Little did he realize how much he would use his drug skills to help him land a legal job at Urban Ashes. Not only was he good with math, remember?
I knew what an eighth was because I sold dope. And so, like, 2/8 is a quarter. 2/16 is an eighth. So
Evans also knew how to network. Back when he was selling drugs, he was all about networking.
The crew that I ran with, my job was to find drug houses and also people to put in the drug house to sell the drugs.
You networked.
Right.
Well, I think it's so interesting. I mean, like, you were talking about, like, your job was to find the houses and then put people in the houses and whatever. I mean, now you're a human resources manager, right? And your job is to find people and put them in this building.
Exactly.
And get them to create beautiful works of art.
Right. And then mentor them along the way.
Joking aside, that last part there, the mentoring part, that's key. That has been Calvin Evans' entire mission since he got out of prison 2.5 years ago. He wants to help ex-cons bridge the gap between life behind bars and life on the outside. And he's doing it with the help of Urban Ashes founder and president, Paul Hickman.
It's like landing on the moon. You know, they come out of prison after 20-some years. You might as well drop them on the moon. They're in a whole different society.
When designer Paul Hickman first started his framing company, Urban Ashes, he did not think his work crew would consist of a bunch of ex-felons. At first, he wasn't sure what to expect. It's human nature, he says, to question how much you can trust somebody who just spent 20 years locked up. But he says all that started to fade away once he worked alongside them in the shop, sawing and cutting and shaping the wood just so. Now he's got 6 employees, 3 of whom are ex-felons. He's trained them, he's mentored them, and he pays them a good wage. And here's what he gets in return.
I've never had a more dedicated crew, a more committed crew to making sure things are done correctly and getting things done on time. They are very proud of what they do. You've got a group of people that may be proud of something for the first time in their life, and that's pretty incredible.
Paul Hickman's business is a small one, though, and he can't just hire a lot of people. So he's now turned his attention to other small business owners, trying to convince them to hire ex-felons just like he did. And he's holding up Urban Ashes as a model. As for Calvin Evans' part, he's on the county's workforce development board to make sure ex-felons have a voice in terms of job opportunities. And he's in the process of setting up a network of folks to do peer-to-peer counseling with ex-felons upon their release. Evans has even gone back to prison, voluntarily, to recruit prisoners on their way out to come work for Urban Ashes, show them there is a way forward, and it comes with a good paycheck. He also mentors the crew he works with right now, just like he used to do back when he was selling drugs.
I'm doing the same thing here. I see one of them doing something that is hazardous to the company, I take them out to lunch. So I'm high count. And so what I do is I'm developing a personal relationship with them. And in developing this personal relationship, I can get them to see the vision of the company.
He tells them, this isn't a job. This is a career. And we want you here. More than 2 million people are behind bars in the United States. And there's a national movement to cut that number in half over the next decade. To have a network of mentors like Calvin Evans and small businesses like Urban Ashes lined up to help with resources and a paycheck, that could mean the difference for some folks between going back to prison and freedom. You've been listening to Connections, The Power of Networks, a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. The State of Opportunity team includes Sarah Alvarez, Dustin Dwyer, and Brittany Barkowiak. Special thanks to independent producer Zach Rosen and our social media producer, Paula Friedrich. Sarah Hewlett edited today's show. Tamar Charney is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer Guerra.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.